This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests. It's Thursday, June 13th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Climate change is the most pressing political issue in the world, and the 23 Democratic candidates for president have ideas about how to address it. For decades, economists have argued for a cap-and-trade system or a carbon tax as the cheapest and most efficient way to reduce CO2 emissions. Now, progressives and climate activists are advocating a different approach, focusing on renewable energy and creating jobs. Their efforts, summed up by the Green New Deal resolutions before Congress, have pushed many of the candidates to the left on the issue. Elizabeth Warren, one of the current frontrunners, spoke about the Green New Deal at a rally in March.
So let's talk just about some of the pieces that are going to be in there. I'll tell you, one of the pieces that's going to be in there is we stop subsidizing fossil fuel companies and we put that money into green energy. We got to rebuild our infrastructure for 21st century and for better resilience. We're going to make changes as a country in conservation, of protecting our federal lands. Oh, can I also say no offshore drilling? And one more piece. We got to put real money into the research that we need for where the best place to make these investments in clean energy going forward are, and to bring down the carbon that's already in the atmosphere.
Robert Stavins, a professor of energy and economic development at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, joins me to discuss the feasibility of these ideas and how the Republican Party is responding. Rob, welcome back. It's been a while.
It's good to be back, Dorothy. Thank you.
You helped to lead the charge on cap and trade during the Obama administration, but the bill that emerged in 2009 didn't pass. Why not?
Well, it passed the House of Representatives exclusively Democratic votes, and then it went on to the Senate, where it was demonized by interest groups from conservative states, and so Republicans as well as coal state Democrats. And it was demonized in a very particular way as cap and tax. And that eventually led to its defeat, the recognition, which is actually valid, the recognition that a cap and trade system passes on costs that don't look terribly different to individual firms and consumers than a carbon tax would.
Tell us briefly what the difference is between cap and trade and a straight carbon tax.
So a carbon tax places a fee or a tax on the three fossil fuels, coal, petroleum, and natural gas, in proportion to their carbon content. And because coal is vastly more carbon intensive than natural gas or petroleum, it really turns out to a large degree to be a tax on coal. That tax then is passed on down along the line in terms of electricity that comes from various sources, manufactured products that come from various sources, and motor vehicle fuels. A cap and trade system winds up being quite symmetric to that, but it does it a little differently. It puts a cap, a quantity constraint, on the total amount of carbon content entering the economy, and then allows the firms to trade among themselves. The result is a market price on these allowances they're trading, and that market price turns out to be the same as what a commensurate tax would be. So in one case, it's the tail wagging the dog. In the other case, the dog is wagging the tail.
Well, and presumably before Republicans and lobbying groups called it cap and tax, cap and trade seemed like a more politically acceptable idea.
Well, right. I mean, for years, going back actually to the Reagan administration, when we used the cap and trade system essentially to phase leaded gasoline out of the market, or the George H.W. Bush administration when we cut acid rain by half, the political advantage of cap and trade was essentially that it sweeps the costs under the rug. It hides the costs because you don't get a discussion about those costs as much, whereas with a tax, of course, you do. I think what's fundamentally changed, and I think for the worst, is that a result of this demonization of cap and trade as cap and tax, that political advantage may now have been dissipated.
So earlier this year, I want to ask you about a piece that David Leonhardt wrote for the New York Times Magazine about the potential problems, as he sees them, with the carbon tax. And he was pushing for performance standards instead. What are performance standards?
So a performance standard is the approach that's used for nearly all other environmental problems. So I'd say if we added up the pages in the Federal Register of Environmental Regulations, probably 98% are going to be performance standards and technology standards. And that's when an individual limit is put on individual firms to reduce their emissions. There's several problems with that, particularly in the case of climate change. Number one is sheer feasibility, because in the case of carbon dioxide emissions, we're not just talking about 1,000 electricity generating plants. We're talking about every electricity generating plant, every manufacturing facility, every commercial facility, every home, every motor vehicle, every backyard barbecue grill and lawnmower. It goes on and on. And the notion of developing individual performance standards for all of those different emission sources is actually ludicrous. It's not going to happen. Therefore, with that approach, you won't be able to feasibly get 100% coverage in the economy. It's also a more costly approach, and in the long term, it's not clear if it will send the price signals that are needed to inspire the massive amount of technological change that's going to be required to do the job.
California is always our lodestar in being a little bit ahead of other states. What has been going on there? They have had a cap-and-trade system in place there, have they not?
Yes. So they have a portfolio, like a lot of jurisdictions do around the world. They have a cap-and-trade system that covers about 85% of the economy, essentially everything but agricultural emissions. They also have standards, something called a low-carbon fuel standard that targets refineries. They have energy efficiency standards, and they have something called renewable portfolio standards, which, as their name implies, constrain, affect electrical generators in terms of the amount of renewable power they're putting into the grid.
Has it been cost-effective and considered a success?
The first thing I'll say is that it's very well designed. It's actually better designed than the world's largest cap-and-trade system, which is in the European Union. It's not perfect. It has, I'd say, been a success in terms of what it can be expected to achieve. There are some unpleasant parts of it. There are some problems with it, in particular how these different policy instruments interact with one another, because it is only one part of a portfolio.
Have other states begun to follow the California model?
So Oregon is about to. Oregon is going to be putting in place a cap-and-trade system in this calendar year. As you probably know, Washington State has twice defeated a carbon tax in referenda at the state level. In the northeast of the United States and the middle Atlantic states, including New York, there is a cap-and-trade system in place called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. So those are the market-based approaches, the carbon pricing approaches. But it should also be noted that vastly larger number of states, essentially a bit more than half of the states, have some kind of renewable standards in place that are intended to affect electricity generation to bring more renewables online.
So it sounds as though there actually, in some of these states, there's more popular support for it than we see in the U.S. Congress. Are Republicans in these states on board?
So there's a mix. I mean, to a first order of approximation, if you look at the blue states and red states from the last general election or back from the Obama elections, the blue states are the ones with the more aggressive climate policies. But there are exceptions to that, and that's the Great Plains and upper Midwest, and then all the way down to Texas. And the reason for that is that from Texas all the way up to North Dakota, that area, which is, of course, heavily red in terms of its representation in the Congress, is also where the greatest wind resources are. So conservative Republicans, including some who talk as if climate change doesn't exist, they're nevertheless extremely supportive of the federal subsidies that exist for wind energy.
So what is the best way to get Americans to understand that they are going to have to pay for the ravages that we have wreaked on the environment? Do you know Nathaniel Keohane at the Environmental Defense Fund?
So not only do I know him, I was his PhD advisor when he did his PhD at Harvard.
He says that the only way to succeed on climate policy is by giving people a vision of what's in it for them, appeal to their selfishness, in other words, in their lives, in their kids' lives, in their grandchildren's lives.
Well, that's the challenge, what Nat said, because the reality of why climate change is such a difficult problem politically is that there are two scientific realities which lead to specific economic implications, which lead to specific political implications. And one of them is that carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases mix in the atmosphere. It doesn't matter where the emissions came from. The result of that is that when an individual jurisdiction, such as a city, a state, or even a country, takes action, it incurs the cost of its taking action, but the benefits are spread globally.
Yes.
And that means that for any individual jurisdiction, if they're looking only at the benefits they're getting in terms of climate change, reduced risk thereof, and the costs that they're incurring, the benefits are going to be less than the costs. That's the definition of a global commons problem, and that's why international cooperation is required for this problem, whereas we don't need it for lots of other environmental issues. The other one is a temporal one, and that is that these greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in particular, have long lag times in the atmosphere, on the order of 100 years. The result of that is the greatest damages are going to be off in the future. We're actually asking representatives in a representative democracy to vote, to put costs on current voters in their jurisdiction when the benefits are largely going to go to future generations in other parts of the world. That's exactly the opposite of what our process reacts well to, namely when the benefits are up front and we put the costs on the future generation or put them on someone else. It also is going to require inspired leadership from the top. And although I'm, you know, been bipartisan for years, I think that was what President Obama certainly sought to provide, was, you know, leadership from the very top. I think that's going to be required rather than bubbling up of demand from the bottom.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So the various Democratic candidates have their policy proposals on climate change. What do you think the most promising and maybe the most implausible of them are?
Well, if I had to say what's most implausible, I suppose it would be those who have given a blanket endorsement of, you know, the Green New Deal. You know, the Green New Deal by economists and other policy wonks like myself has been heavily criticized because there aren't specific policies. I've come to the conclusion that, in a sense, that's an unfair criticism because it's really not a policy proposal. I now see the Green New Deal as essentially being a movement.
Yes.
And, you know, trying to critique or compliment a movement is over my pay grade. But the goals that are in the Green New Deal are fundamentally unreachable in many cases. And then there's this, from my perspective, unfortunate reality of mixing together some environmental objectives, such as, you know, greater penetration of renewables, with what are essentially a populist, somewhat left of center set of economic proposals, you know, guaranteeing a job to every family with at a certain wage level, adequate family and medical leave, paid vacations, retirement security. I could go on and on. It's quite a list that's in the Green New Deal release.
Sometimes you need a movement to get any change at all, especially in this political climate where we have a president who thinks that climate change is a hoax, or at least he says he thinks it's a hoax.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I don't disagree at all with what you just said. I actually fundamentally agree with that. Movements can spur effective policy proposals and action. Whether or not this one will, it's just obviously much too soon to be able to say that. Some of the candidates, while not necessarily giving a blanket endorsement to the Green New Deal, and I guess I would include Vice President Biden in this, but I don't mean to favor him as an individual, then go beyond that to enumerate specific policy mechanisms in the sense that we usually think of real policies.
So what about Elizabeth Warren, who takes great pride in the fact that she has a plan for just about anything you might raise?
Yeah, well, she's certainly detailed. I'll give her that. So there are aspects of what she says that are sound in terms of when she gets into policy proposals. I'm always concerned about the soaring rhetoric that really takes us back to Jill Stein's 2012 presidential campaign for the Green Party. Mm-hmm. Remember, she ran on a platform with, quote-unquote, the Green New Deal. It's possible that we'll see fundamental political change in the U.S. with the rise of a Green Party, as in Europe, where the Green Party, although it has the word green, is fundamentally a far left of center, somewhat socialist political party. Maybe that will arise, and part of that movement will indeed be more attention to climate change. But, you know, that's something that's far off, I think, in the future.
What about Republicans? You've worked with so many of them over the years on climate change. Do you see anyone in the National Party reacting to the growing acceptance of the fact that we must address climate change right now?
So there are Republicans, although it's a relatively small number, who have been supportive of action on climate change. One is Republican Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida, who has said that the Republican Party needs to advance sound conservative proposals to address climate change and to embrace the science.
Because the whole state is going underwater.
Essentially, that's why. I mean, again, in this case, it's a local issue with his constituency.
What about the oil and gas industry? They had a week-long energy conference in March in Houston, and I gather it featured speeches by CEOs of big oil and gas companies about how we have to accept the fact that we're going to have a low-carbon future and that the industry has to kind of reinvent itself.
So the oil and gas companies are quickly and methodically diversifying. Now, their first move in diversification is into natural gas, which was a natural for them because they see that that market is going to expand. But there are also many of them are going beyond that to investments in carbon capture and storage and also into investments in renewables. There's a huge difference between the position of the oil and gas companies and the coal companies. The coal companies are strongly opposed to any kind of climate policy whatsoever. They're the voice of climate skepticism. But remember, for the oil and gas companies, it means increased costs, shrinking market share. For a coal company, it's existential.
Yeah. Well, so what do you think about carbon capture?
So carbon capture and storage and better yet, even utilization of that carbon in terms of some kind of products, such as for paving roads, that could be the silver bullet that's eventually found that will lower costs tremendously. But up until this point in time, carbon capture and storage remains costly at a sufficient scale. We know how to do it at small scale. It's been done for years. For 30 or 40 years, the oil industry has used carbon dioxide to pump underground for tertiary and secondary recovery of oil that's still there after they pump out the easier, cheaper oil to extract. So we know how to do it, but it turns out because that itself is a very energy-intensive process that is not at this point cost-effective.
Rob, how discouraged are you, given where we are right now? What do you see in the coming years about how we are going to be grappling with this problem, which, as you've been pointing out, is a conundrum on so many levels?
So I think it's going to be a problem that is with us for a substantial period of time. There will be fits and starts where there's progress, like there was with the Paris Agreement, and then there will be things that politically happened in Brazil or happened in the United States. In terms of my degree of optimism or pessimism, to be completely honest with you, Dorothy, when I think about my children or my grandchildren, which I don't have yet, climate change is not what I worry about. What I'm worrying about now is the future of, you know, American democracy, the role of the press in our democracy, the future of NATO, the future of our alliances with other countries. There are other aspects of the current administration that, for me, are much more worrisome than their rhetoric and their limited action on climate change.
Thanks so much, Rob.
My pleasure.
Robert Stavins is the A.J. Meyer Professor of Energy and Economic Development at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Jill Dubuff with assistance from Kylie Warner. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.